Welcome to RJI's podcast series, hosted by Lisa Ray. Restorative Justice International is an association and network with over 5,700 members and affiliates. In this podcast series, Lisa interviews leaders in the restorative justice field from around the globe, as well as speaking to crime victims and ex-offenders who have participated in restorative justice themselves. The podcast series will allow you to hear from key thought leaders about issues related to crime and justice from a restorative justice perspective. Now, here's Lisa Ray.
Today's podcast is about the life and legacy of John Hume. Mr. Hume died on August 3rd at the age of 83 in Londonderry, Ireland. This podcast is produced today in his honor. Hume was a visionary Irish nationalist politician and a statesman from Northern Ireland, widely regarded as one of the most important figures in the recent political history of Ireland and a principal architect of the Northern Ireland's 1998 peace agreement. A native of Derry, Hume was a founding member of the Socialist Democratic and Labour Party, serving as its second leader from 1979 to 2001. He also served as a member of the European Parliament, a member of the UK Parliament, and a member of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Hume was a co-recipient of the 1998 Nobel Peace Prize with David Trimble and received the Gandhi Peace Prize and the Martin Luther King Award. Today's guests to talk about the Hume's legacy include Pat Hines and Austin Stack. Pat is the program manager for the Glencree Center for Peace and Reconciliation in Ireland and has led its community and political dialogue program since 2015. Throughout the 1990s, Pat worked with various government ministers in the early years of the peace process, later participating in Glencree's political dialogue workshops leading up to the Good Friday Breakfast Agreement. Pat is an adjunct faculty member of Maynooth University. Austin Stack is a founding member of the Independent Victims and Survivors Coalition and a campaigner for the Post-Conflict Commission in Ireland. He is the son of Brian Stack, the chief prison officer in Port Leash Prison, who was shot and fatally wounded by the IRA in 1983. Faced with constant denials by the IRA and Sinn Féin and a lack of progress in the police investigation, Austin opened a line of communication with Sinn Féin's leadership. Using restorative justice principles, Austin and his brother met with IRA leadership in 2013. The IRA admitted to his father's murder, but questions remain to this day. Austin works as an advocate for restorative justice and now serves on RJI's Global Advisory Council. Welcome to you both.
Good afternoon, Lisa.
And hello.
Good afternoon, Lisa. Thank you.
Great to have you and honor John Hume today. And so the first question I have is to you, Pat. We recently had a Zoom conversation about the legacy of this great leader. So what does his legacy mean to you, and what was his commitment to peace and dialogue?
I think, in analyzing John's career, what was most profound and influential for all of us on this side of the island was his ability to reframe the question, the age-old question, in relation to Ireland as a divided territory. And he reframed the question around being a divided people, and that only through agreement among our people, in all their diversity, could we find a way forward out of the violence that had characterized our history up to that point in 1998.
And I know that's a big question to say, what is his legacy? So we'll keep moving through this as we look at his career and his contribution to peace. So Austin, on the peace process and breaking down barriers for peace, how was Hume able to open doors for communication with Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams? What are your thoughts on that?
I suppose John Hume took a huge risk in reaching out to Gerry Adams at the time that he did. There had been a lot of back channels going on for a number of years, but John Hume took a huge chance, both personally and politically, in reaching out to Gerry Adams and the Sinn Féin organisation to essentially bring them in from the cold. And I suppose that without John Hume taking that risk, the peace process would never actually have taken off. And, the end of the day, Hume's own party essentially suffered in the long term as a result of bringing Sinn Féin in from the cold. But it was required at the time that someone take the political risk to do that. And, you know, it's the one, John Hume took an awful lot of flack in the media and in political circles in, particularly in the South, for having reached out to Sinn Féin. But, you know, when we analyse that now and look back at it now, that risk was a risk that was worth taking and as a risk that paid off, I suppose, in peace terms, but politically for his own party, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, it didn't actually pay dividends for them.
Interesting. And so, Pat, what are your thoughts on that, about him reaching out to Sinn Féin?
It was very controversial at the time. There had been a sustained period of over 20 years of violence in which there were a lot of deaths and casualties. A lot of innocent people had lost their lives. And it was a huge political risk for him to take in engaging Gerry Adams, because what was actually being envisaged was to open a seam for Sinn Féin and the Republican movement to enter the democratic process and the democratic world of politics, which they had refused to participate in up to that point. And many political parties, in fact, all political parties, refused to speak with them or meet them while they continued their campaign of violence. But what Hume considered and deduced at the end of it was they actually believed in what they were doing and that their violence was in effect pursuing, in their view, an end. And that if he could find ways of ending the conflict through identifying the reasons which gave rise to it, then he had a chance of getting it to stop. And that involved a long and sustained period of discussion and negotiation between himself and Gerry Adams, some of which had taken place under the auspices of the priests of the Clonard Monastery in Belfast, but in other locations as well. Hume and Adams continued to speak and ultimately created the circumstances which arose around the creation of the Downing Street Declaration, which was a set of principles upon which future political movement would be based upon. And that, of course, occurred in 1993. So all the principles around which the furtherance of the process would take place were identified between 1987, 88 and 1993. But throughout that period, and Austin's quite right to highlight this, he sustained a huge degree of criticism in the media as a consequence of that effort.
Yes, BBC film in his honor, talking about his career. And it actually had an excerpt where he was saying that he would continue to speak to Gerry Adams no matter what and continue to seek peace with Sinn Féin. So he started that conversation, you said, Pat, it wasn't in 1994, it was long before that. Is that right?
He had long identified that violence in a divided society only deepened the problem, and that our history had taught us in Ireland that violence had no place in the resolution of our disputes. What we required and what was needed was a political process and a long and sustained dialogue where we would repair the broken relationships that had given rise to the conflict. We'd broken relations between people within Northern Ireland, between people north and south across the island, and the age-old enmity, of course, that existed between Britain and Ireland. And he envisaged the creation of a three-stranded process that would work at repairing those broken relationships. And beginning as early as the 1970s was identifying this as a template and as the basis upon which we could work towards repairing those relationships. And of course, his role in Europe was hugely influential. I mean, when he stood on the bridge in Strasbourg between Germany and France and said to himself, you know, the Germans are still German, the French are still French, despite fighting each other for almost 150 years, they were now working in their common interests on economic and social and other issues around a common identity, which was, of course, a European identity, which in a way dispelled many of the difficulties that had characterized the nationalisms that that had given rise to the conflicts across Europe. So this was a big influential factor in his thinking, even in respect of our conflict. And so when he sat down with, as it were, the Republican movement, it was this, you know, overriding concept of working with people who you didn't necessarily share the entirety of the political outlook, but ultimately there were bread and butter issues around economic and social development and so on that existed across the political divide and across the identities, and that they could be issues that could be worked upon. So he had a great sense of social justice about himself as well, going right back to the 1960s in his native city of Derry. So all of these factors came together to influence him in his efforts to reach some degree of compromise with the Republican movement.
Pat, you and I were having a call recently, and you said, and we know this is accurate, 1998, the Good Friday Agreement was signed. And then what was miraculous really was that the violence and the bombing really stopped. And I guess some would have thought maybe that wouldn't even have occurred, but it did. So why did it stop?
I think it's important now to be careful as well. I mean, for the majority of the provisional IRA, they had reached the conclusion, much like the, I suppose, the characteristic definition of a hurting stalemate. They weren't going to win and they weren't going to be defeated. Now, there were some elements, I have to point out, within that Republican movement, within the IRA, who did not accept and would not accept that violence had no place in the pursuit of their aims and demands. And they did break away, and there were people who formed what we might call dissident splinter groups. And they continued to wage violence, albeit at a much lower intensity level than before. But not everybody accepted the terms of the agreement. What did happen, however, was that the vast majority of the Republican movement, Sinn Féin and others, they did accept that there was a political alternative, and that they could pursue their aims and their objectives through democratic and political means. And that meant persuading people and winning the consent of people for their objective around a united Ireland or whatever that might be. But fundamentally and before that, what we had to resolve and what we had to do was to agree that we had, as I said before and he said before, relationships that needed to be repaired, because we didn't really know people on the other part of the island, and we weren't really, in a sense, clear about their fears and concerns and so on. And what the agreement allowed us to do was, you know, end to a very large extent the very intensive violence that had characterized the period up to that point, and to develop relationships across the island with people who had up to that point been either fearful or found it difficult to engage either on a political, social or cultural level even with people in the south. So it was quite transformative in that sense, in that it created that atmosphere as he envisaged it would, it should be pointed out.
Yes, let's just look at your life and the loss of your father in 1983 due to Sinn Féin. So how did you see this when your father was killed? Take us through that. I mean, you're a victim of this violence.
I suppose when the Good Friday Agreement was announced, the people north and south were asked to vote on it. And I had a lot of concerns in it. And, you know, as a family, myself and the rest of my family discussed it. And we were split down the middle about whether to support it or not, particularly around the issue of prisoner releases and how that should be managed. And we straight away, myself and my mother in particular, would have seen that there were a lot of questions about the legacy stuff around victims. And that hadn't been built into the agreement. And, you know, we saw initially that, you know, the whole tenure of the agreement was around making the bombs and the bullets stop and getting a political settlement, getting institutions up and running in Northern Ireland. So to bring the men of violence into the democratic process. But initially I voted actually against the agreement particularly on the grounds of the prisoner releases and the fact that there was nothing in it in relation to what was going to happen after we got the bombs and bullets stopped and after we got the institutions up and running. You know, how were they going to deal with the legacy stuff? How were they going to? And I don't know, because I wasn't obviously involved in the negotiations as to whether that was actually discussed, whether that was thought about. But from a perspective of a number of years later, and you look back on it now, I mean, I've had discussions with people within Sinn Féin, and they would have been quite adamant. You know, they said to me, well, look, Aston, prisoner release has been a feature of every agreement around the world. I accepted that at this stage, but I did feel at the time it was handled very, very badly. Because I can remember my own mother having to sit in the front room here and watch on TV these guys getting out of prison, hardened terrorists, waving flags and partying. And, you know, that was very hard to take. That was very hard to take. And from that perspective, I suppose, you know, while I was in favour of the peace process, there were certain elements of it didn't allow me to support it at the time. But after I saw the institutions and that up and running and saw that the peace was actually working, I came round to it. I did engage with Gerry Adams myself.
Yes.
And I did find that up to a point that Sinn Féin would be prepared to talk to people, but I also found that there was a point from which they were not prepared to go any further. They would talk to you up to a point, and then, you know, what they didn't want to go there was accepting responsibility for their actions, about taking responsibility for their actions, about engaging with victims. And, you know, I know that several families, particularly in relation to the Enniskillen bomb atrocity, reached out to Sinn Féin and Martin McGuinness in particular when he was Deputy First Minister, and those calls were ignored because of the sensitivities around it, that the political people in Sinn Féin didn't want to engage with victims and didn't want to engage with the legacy issues, while they reached out to political unionism and you know, worked with political unionism in the institutions to make the institutions in the assembly in Northern Ireland work. The long-term effects have been, and, you know, we're talking now 25 years later, and it's quite evident that the legacy issues had been left to one side when the peace agreement was being negotiated. And I don't know if, because I wasn't involved, I don't know if John Hume would have seen that. I don't know whether he would have had any influence on that. I think his main prerogative would have been to make the violence stop, to get the institutions up and running, and then to try and frame the dialogue mm-hmm. around making both communities work together and see how the island could progress from that perspective.
Okay, yes. And for those that are listening also, RJI did a podcast with Austin Stack, so there's a very detailed conversation that they could find on our site. So, Pat, reflecting on what Austin just said about his own experience, do you think something was missing in the negotiated peace agreement? Do you think John Hume was applying restorative justice principles and that he was also looking to brings some healing in the lives of the victims and accountability in the offender?
I think he was acutely aware. And I mean, he'd said before, and in fact, many times, that the greatest injustice throughout the Troubles was the taking of human life. That people could come out of paramilitary organizations, people could come out of prisons, but people could not come out of their graves. So he was acutely aware that the violence was creating extreme levels of injustice at that very fundamental level around human life. And he was never one to shy away from, as it were, as some people might describe, criticizing his own side in that activity. But he was very firmly focused, as Austin has just said, in getting that violence to stop and thereafter getting those institutions up and running in the hope that people would, in a sense, realize the futility of what had gone on for a quarter century on the island and the futility of all of the loss of life in terms of what was ultimately achieved as a consequence of it. Because only when the violence stopped and only when people stopped losing their lives did we begin to make the kind of progress that, you know, is heralded today around institutions and so on. So I think what, you know, if we were to reflect, I mean, one of the inadequacies, I suppose, of the process is that it hasn't really been effective in getting organizations that were once engaged in violence to really acknowledge to those who were harmed and who lost loved ones and who today continue to seek answers around what happened, that there's not a real level of acknowledgement and hasn't been a process that has seen a real engagement where people can get a sense that, you know, they are acknowledged and that what happened was wrong. And I think that is something, and Austin has identified this before, that is something that, you know, continues to be something absent in the process even to this day.
Mm-hmm. And Pat kind of touched on this already a little bit, but I kind of want you to talk a little bit about John Hume's commitment to nonviolence and his commitment to restorative justice. I'm not sure how much the words restorative justice were used by John, but what are your thoughts on that? Where did it come from in his life?
He grew up in the city of Derry. I mean, he was born in 1937. Derry was a divided city. It was where the two communities really met in strength. It was like a microcosm of Northern Ireland at the time. Many Catholics, of course, were living in what, you know, were accepted at the time as particularly disadvantaged conditions in terms of housing and employment opportunities and so on. Very, very, very poor financial and meager subsistence for many of them to live and exist on without employment or opportunities. He spent his life, early part of his life, addressing those fundamental problems around, you know, civil rights. I mean, he was, you know, in the 1960s when your, I suppose, country was listening to the words of Kennedy and Martin Luther King and so on, he was particularly moved by action, but not violent action. He was moved by peaceful protest and non-violent opposition to what he seen as a political system that was not behaving in a fair manner towards his community. He also had the advantage of being that generation. The Butler Education Act of 1947 was a United Kingdom-wide act that gave opportunities for everybody, regardless of background or identity or anything else, the opportunity to go on to third level education. And this resulted in the development of a generation of people like Hume and others who suddenly found voice and articulation at a time when the rest of the world and people of his age were also awakening around injustices, around civil rights and so on. So in terms of, you know, a restorative justice approach, he saw lots of injustices in his own city and sought to address them, as I've said, by nonviolent means and worked for the rest of, I suppose, his life at opposing any kind of violence because he would say very, very often, you know, in a divided society, violence will only deepen the problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was proven correct in that. It did deepen the problem. And here we are 25 years after the ceasefires with so much trauma and so much anxiety as a consequence of what people lived through those 30 years of the Troubles from the late 1960s up until the late 1990s. So in a sense, you know, restorative justice, I think he was very much into restoring relationships. Mm-hmm. He knew that the relationships had been broken and that there was no other way of restoring and repairing them other than through the effort at humanizing them through structures where people came together, met each other, understood each other, understood the fears of each other, and in that way humanized their understanding of the other rather than, as it were, behaving around what they thought the other was as a consequence of labels that were attached throughout the conflict. So restorative justice, I would say, yes, but it with a particular focus on restoring relationships.
And many in this field, as you know, really believe that restorative justice is about repairing relationships, restoring relationships. And also I was thinking of something I read about John Hume's life, that he was a man of faith, and that faith really affected what he did with his life. Isn't that right, Pat?
He was actually a student at the seminary in Maynooth.
Yes.
So he had studied, in fact, for a religious life, but opted not to pursue it in the end. But many of the tenets of his thought processes, you know, were probably honed and developed through his studies in Maynooth. This inexorable attachment to logic. He was an incredibly logical man, identifying very, very early on, like that partition, for example, was not something that was a choice, but rather a reflection of reality, because we had a divided people on the island. People were divided in their minds, and as a consequence were fearful, and therefore what you needed to do was to create structures which would break down the mistrust, break down the misunderstanding, and create opportunities, as I said earlier, for people to more fundamentally understand where they were coming from. So all of that logic, and I remember, you know, and I mean, Austin can comment on this himself, he had a profoundly strong influence on all of us growing up in those 1980s and 90s. He was the guy that we looked to in terms of the direction of travel that really we should go. People like Guy, myself, and others in Austin, we were not minded to in any way identify with the use of violence as a tool or a mechanism that was going to advance any of this 1 millimeter. But where we were moved and where we were influenced was what Hume was saying around the creation of a peaceful process to repair relations with those who we differed in political terms.
So
I think the evidence, just to finish, the evidence of his impact was that on the 22nd of May 1998, 94.6% of the population on this side of the island in the Republic voted for the agreement. And that was the kind of impact that his thinking and thought processes had, I think, on most of us down here.
Mm-hmm. And Austin, do you have thoughts on this?
Sorry, Lisa.
Well, we were just talking about kind of the foundation of John's thinking, but also I asked Pat to comment on John's faith, that he was a man of faith, and that really did affect the work he did. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, as Pat said, that, you know, John Hume was initially entered a seminary in Maynooth to study for the priesthood, and he decided that that wasn't for him, and he got married and he became a teacher. Also, you know, I have many friends in the nationalist community in the north, and they will tell you that the one thing that they have always held on to in Northern Ireland, the nationalist community, is their religion and their faith. Because it is something that has kind of identified them and as who they are and as part of their culture. And I suppose John was no different to any other person of the nationalist persuasion in Northern Ireland, but his thinking was obviously very influenced by his time in the seminary in Maynooth. I suppose, you know, myself and Pat would have been very politically active in our younger days, and our thinking, as Pat said, would have very much have been influenced by John's thinking on this. And myself and Pat have had a lot of discussions around this, and, you know, we would be of the opinion, I think, that you try to unite people rather than unite territory. And, you know, and that the only way that that solutions to problems are going to be found, and that the conflict that happened on this island that is going to truly find a resolution is if people become united, if people become you know, we take what John Hume has as his legacy and bring it to another level by trying to get people from the North, from particularly from the unionist persuasion, to start coming down to the South and meeting people, engaging with people, talking to people. Likewise, people from the South to up to the North and engage with people in the unionist community. Because, you know, that doesn't happen. I mean, the first time I went to Northern Ireland was to Belfast in about 2006. And Pat will recall, we were doing a peace weekend in Glencree a number of years ago, and we invited some people from the families from the unionist persuasion whose loved ones had been killed. They were members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, and a lot of them were very nervous about coming down across the border into Southern Ireland. And, you know, when they came down, their fears were allayed, and you know, having spent a weekend with us, they had a completely different perception of what life was like in the South, of how they will be perceived down here. And many of them have actually, I'm still in contact with them, and they come down here now for weekends away in Cork and Kerry and Galway. And, you know, that fear is gone. And I think we need to do more of that. And, you know, that is, I think, a direct result. My thinking, Pat's thinking, would have been very much heavily influenced by that train of thought by John Hume, that what we should do is unite peoples rather than unite territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, build relationship. And so, Pat, I want to kind of bring it up to date and say, you know, I'm going to ask you both, you know, where are we today in Ireland after 30 years? Is there, would you say there's true peace at present?
You know, like you gotta work at this every day. Repairing relationships isn't an event, it's a process. And so the effort goes on through the institutions that exist, the Northern Ireland Executive and the Assembly, where power is shared between the two identities. The relations between North and South through the North-South Ministerial Council continues to function, where the government in Dublin meet and cooperate with their interlocutors in Belfast. And obviously there's some difficulty as a consequence of the decision by the United Kingdom to leave the European Union.
Yes.
So
yes.
That is creating, I suppose, some challenges that we will have to work through and deal with. But I think, you know, what's most important today, and many of the people who, of course, fought the conflict are reaching ages where they're passing on. And it is going to be important in that context, I believe, for the, you know, the past to be laid to rest in the right way. And that where people are looking for information or answers, that every effort should be made by organizations engaged in the conflict of the past to, you know, really make an effort to meet the concerns and meet the needs of those who have lost loved ones and so on. That's going to be a big challenge going forward. And the whole concept of how we're going to do history and so on, and how we're going to see ourselves. Northern Ireland will be 100 years in existence in June of next year, centenary. And we're going through a centenary of celebrations and commemorations on this island, on this part of the island, over the course of the last few years and the next few years to come. So we have to find ways of doing history with each other and not to each other. And that's going to be a big challenge. But as I said, in terms of the 30 years of the conflict between the late 1960s and 1990s, I think we need to make a real effort to create processes where people can come forward and provide the kind of answers to questions, and insofar as they can, undo some of the harm that was done as a consequence of the conflict that it raised for so long.
And Austin, I'm going to ask you a similar question, but first I actually want to read a statement. There were so many tributes to John Hume after his death around the world. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who pushed for the 1998 peace agreement while in office, as you know, said in a tribute to Hume, quote, "His legacy will live on in every generation of Northern Ireland's young people who make John's choice to live free of the hatred and horror of sectarian violence," unquote. And so, Austin, I was going to ask you a question about, Ireland today, but also thinking about the victims of violence like yourself and the effect that violence still has on families and especially youth. So how do you think restorative justice plays a part in bringing more healing and peace to Ireland and Northern Ireland today?
I think the first thing in relation to that, you know, that statement would be that I think that the biggest tribute that we today could pay to John Hume would be to move from the sectarian setup that Northern Ireland is, the Parliament in Northern Ireland, the Assembly, is structured in a very sectarian way. that people elected to the parliament have to declare whether they're nationalist or unionist. And in my view, that still drives sectarianism. That still creates a divide. And I think the biggest thing that we could do to enhance John Hume's legacy would be to move away from that and allow political discussion to be framed around housing, around unemployment, around the everyday needs of the people, rather than around whether you're actually declaring, you know, you're a unionist or a nationalist. And in my view, I think that structures and political dialogue should center around that going forward. From the perspective of the legacy from victims, I have firmly believed that some sort of a restorative commission is the only way forward. What's written into the Stormont House Agreement, which was supposed to deal with the legacy of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, is not going to be helpful to victims. Essentially, what they have written into that is that there is a truth commission. And essentially what would happen would be, if I as a victim wanted to get some truth in relation to my dad's murder, I would ask the commission to get involved. They would go to a third party who would then go as an intermediary to the IRA to try and get some answers. That third party would come back to me with the information. Mm. Okay. I would have to accept that information at face value. The problem I have with that is that I cannot test that information. I cannot ask questions around that information. I am not directly involved in the process. And I was directly involved in a process with Gerry Adams myself, in which I went to meet with the IRA. They told me about 70% of the truth. And when they told me what I felt was the lie, I was actually able to question them on it. Mm-hmm. And that is the difference. I really, really firmly believe that some sort of a truth and reconciliation commission, in which the victim is very much involved in a restorative process, the victim can then, at the end of that process, say to the people, the commissioner who is in charge of it, look, I've been dealt with very fairly by these people. I have got my truth. Now we can talk about amnesties. And I believe that that's how it should be done. I know Sinn Féin, when I spoke to them, Gerry Adams, wanted amnesties at the start of a process. But you can't give out the candy to the child before it does what it's told. You have to give the reward at the end, and that would be my view on it. But I do think we need to frame discussions around the legacy in a true, to get true restorative. And I mean, in my own studies, I have spoken to victims, particularly victims of a unionist persuasion. And when you ask them the question, do they want truth? 94% of them said they would want truth. Most people realise that 20, 30, 40, 50 years after their loved ones have been killed, that they're not going to get justice in a courtroom, but that they do want to find the answers in another way. And I think we could honour Hume's legacy by addressing that. And as I said, the other way we could honour Hume's legacy would be to move to a normal political discourse in Northern Ireland, rather than the sectarian political way that we are operating at the moment.
Yes. Well, we're coming to the close of the podcast, but Pat, let me just ask you a kind of a broad question here at the end. What is the lasting effect of John Hume's work on Ireland?
Sorry, would you repeat that?
What do you think is the lasting effect of John Hume's work on Ireland? I know, a huge question. Kind of your closing comments about John's life.
There are so many kind of, you know, impacts that he had. I mean, I think, and again, I'm speaking as a Southerner, and I don't know whether Austin would share this, he really challenged us as Southerners to think about how we've seen the other community on the island of Ireland. So we used to have these, you know, slogans by, you know, Republicans and others, you know, Brits go home and Brits out and everything else, you know. But who were the Brits? Who were the British presence? The British presence on the island of Ireland are the million or so unionists who we have to share this place with, and create a shared home place where they feel as comfortable and as acknowledged and as valued as we would like to feel. And I think that he left that challenge to us all through his work and through his efforts politically over the course of his career. So I think, you know, he leaves us a legacy, but he, as he always did, he challenged us. He certainly challenged my generation to look at this problem, this difficulty, the violence and everything else in relational terms. And how are we going to create a place and a space on this island, as I say, that is safe, that is inclusive, and that threatens nobody's identity or their sense of themselves. I think that was a huge achievement, and he did that from you know, the perspective of some very, very difficult and tough beginnings in terms of where he came from and the journey that he embarked on through his life. So as I say, it's a legacy, but it's also a challenge to each of us and for succeeding generations. I think I read somewhere recently, one of the greatest obligations I think we have as human beings is to be good ancestors in the course of our lives, to act as though we are to become good ancestors. And I think Hume will be seen, and people will reflect in years and decades to come, that he was one of our greatest ancestors.
Well, that's a great way to phrase it. And I want to thank you both. And let me leave us with these thoughts. May we continue to reflect the work of John Hume in all we do, as we are committed to peacemaking, peace building, and restorative justice. Thank you both. This is Lisa Ray for Restorative Justice International.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the RJI podcast series with Lisa Ray. Stay in touch and support our work at restorativejusticeinternational.com.